This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, a new report questions whether Michigan should steer its economic strategy away from tax cuts and invest in roads, education, the environment, and other areas. But first, gangsters in Southwest Michigan? It's not as shocking as you think. Back in the 1920s, members of the Chicago crime scene treated the area as an oasis, where they dined, played golf, and did their best to keep their business affairs to a minimum. That all changed in 1929 when gangster Frank Killer Burke murdered a South Haven police officer, leading authorities to discover that he had weapons used in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, where seven men from an opposing crime gang were killed in Chicago. Author and historian Chris Lyon explores the events in her new book, A Killing in Capone's Playground. She spoke with WMUK's Aaron Williams about the area's undercover past.
Most people will associate the gangster era and the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and Al Capone and everything that goes with that with Chicago. And that's a pretty much a known thing. We've all been taught that in school. We've seen the movies about it. We watch the TV shows. And the one thing that I was always interested in is what happened, say, on February 15th? What happened after the St. Valentine's Day Massacre? And I was really interested in finding that out. And then being that I'm from this area, it was a little known fact that this area played a huge role in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre aftermath. And very few people really know that. And my goal was to educate people in this history that we have here that has taken us into a whole new level. And if you think about the forensics and the ballistics science that we have today, most of that is based on what happened here in 1929 in St. Joseph, Michigan.
And to take us back to that, there was a murder that took place. Basically, there was a police officer who was killed over a minor offense. What was that?
Well, what happened was, and seemed to be somewhat of an unrelated event, was a police officer had tried to stop a motorist who had a car accident and basically left the scene of an accident. And he was trying to get him to stop, to pull over, so they could go over to the police department and settle up the damage. And instead of going right to the police department, the man in the vehicle shot and killed the police officer. And his name was Charles Skelly. He was a 25-year-old male from St. Joseph. And he really had no reason to believe there was anything connected. But once they found the suspect's vehicle, which had crashed down the road a little ways, they ended up finding out where the person lived at, and they ended up going to his house. And the house was located in Stevensville, Michigan. And what they found in the house was something more than what the average person would have, including two Thompson submachine guns, a sawed-off shotgun, several rifles, and dozens of revolvers, and thousands of rounds of ammunition. And they knew at that point there was something to this. And just so happened to be that there was a man named Calvin Goddard who was in Chicago studying the Thompson submachine guns that were used in the massacre. They knew at that point that two Thompson submachine guns had been used in the massacre. They just did not have them. And when they found conveniently two of them in this man's house, they further did some research and they did some fingerprint investigations. And lo and behold, it happens to be a suspect in the massacre named Fred Killer Burke. And he was named as a suspect early on in the investigation in March of 1929. So in December 14th of 1929, was literally 10 months after the massacre, all of this evidence turns up and it tied directly to the massacre and the suspect. And when they actually got the guns in their hands, they were taken to Chicago to be studied. They were determined to be ballistically the actual guns used in the massacre. And this was the most evidence they had ever recovered up until that point and since.
Wow. Obviously, he didn't want to be tracked down because he knew that as soon as that police officer found him, it would lead to all this other stuff.
Exactly. And to think, this is just the tip of the iceberg, and this is really what led everyone to know that the gangsters were in this area, and they were living as amongst us as normal citizens. They weren't committing crimes. necessarily. And this really, I think, struck people a little bit differently. And to think that, you know, right amongst us walking on the same streets are the most wanted criminals in the country. And this was the case with Fred Killer Burke. He had been named as a suspect in the massacre. And here he is living in a home in Stevensville that he had purchased in September of 1929. And he's going by the alias name of Fred Dane. And so all the people in the area and businesses and neighbors knew him as Fred Dane. Never ever suspected him of committing a crime. Certainly not one like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And so it was a real wake-up call for us. But that story is never told when you learn about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. They always tell you about the Chicago part, but they seem to forget the part, what happened afterward. And that's the part that involves southwestern Michigan. And to me, it's the most important part because it really almost solves the crime, even though it was never officially solved. It was as close as you can get to solving a crime at the point that we have now.
Now, this is not something that you typically hear about in modern day history about Michigan. Why do you feel that it's, I don't want to say it's been forgotten, but why do you feel like it's been overlooked?
You know, and I think because of the nature of it with being a small town police officer, a small town incident, and it just seems to be kind of one of those things that history overlooks often with a lot of things. It's the big cities. We want to associate the big cities with the crimes and the gangsters and bloody Chicago and, you know, the beer wars. But we don't want to admit that maybe there were some other things going on in our small cities and small towns. This area was very rural. You know, we were farmers. We did a lot of farming industry. There was some bootlegging that was going on, just like it was across the nation. But I think that a lot of it has almost been forgotten because the people in the area almost want to forget about it. It's not something that maybe necessarily the town people were proud of, and they felt a little somewhat betrayed by the gangsters. And that's what I want to do, is I want to get the story out from the people that were here, remember it, and have a direct connection with it. And I've been surprised to have had so many people that have information about it. Either their grandparents were a part of it or they had another connection somehow with it. And it's amazing when you can put it all together and fit a big puzzle together and see a whole different side of the story that never was told.
And tell me more about that. How was it finding, because obviously, you know, this happened 9 decades ago. So who were you able to talk with that still had some sort of correlation with these events?
Well, it turns out that a lot of the police officers that were involved in the local aspect of it here in Berrien County and in the state police, they actually have descendants that are still in the area. And in fact, one of them just happens to be my boss, who is a grandson of one of the deputies that took Killer Burke to prison and had actually had several conversations with him. And so it was amazing to be able to hear what it was like behind the scenes almost, because usually you just get the impression of what was going on from the newspapers. And that was the main form of information back then. But here you get a different view. You get somebody that was behind the scenes and had a different impression, and maybe some of the more details that were never revealed during the normal press conference that they had. And I think it made the characters come to life a little bit more. And you actually saw a softer side of them. You know, sad to say that you don't want to think of a gangster as being a good guy, but there was some human factors involved where they did come out and they were somewhat compassionate in some form.
How long did it take you to do all the research and to finally put this book together?
The whole writing process was about 5 years. And I think during that time, it was probably maybe a couple of years before that I actually started research. But what I found was I couldn't just write it from an outline, an established outline, because as soon as I began doing that, and I would find out more information that would take the story in a different direction. And so I almost had to research it and write it almost at the same time. And again, some of the things that I found out weren't very typical. you know, being that I work in the public safety industry, of course, I want our police officers to be our heroes. And in some cases, I found that some of the police officers weren't the heroes, and sometimes they were the bad guys. And some of the gangsters, who obviously you want them to be the bad guys, they're actually kind of good in a way. And so something like that, it may be hard to write and hard to accept, but it's what happened, and it's what people said happened. And that's what I want to get out, is, you know, the real story of what happened after that.
What is it that made you decide that, you know what, I want to go and, like, what made you really want to, like, dig in and say, I want to write a book about this?
I think it was just something that stirred me because of previous attempts to tell this part of the story were very maybe shallow attempts, where they didn't really get into the story. They basically gave a skimmed over version and essentially a rehashing of the newspaper article. And I knew there was a lot more to it. And when I really started to decide I wanted to do this, I actually sent out a FOIA request to the state of Michigan, and I received probably about 300 pages worth of memos, police reports, witness statements, testimony, coroner's information, and so much information that it was obvious that there was going to have to be a book written about it. And I knew I had enough information, and I wanted to tell the story, the full story, not just the last day of Charles Skelly's life, but his life in general and what led up to it, what happened afterward, and what we've learned from it since.
I feel like this is one of those events that it happens, you know, it's like, oh, you know, this is unfortunate. This man died, mm-hmm. but I don't think that he realized that his death was not going to be in vain. Obviously, he didn't realize that, but you know, do you get what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and that's the beauty. That's really the beauty of it all, because I think that deep down, he knew he was going to die. He said that he knew he had been shot and he knew he was fading away. I don't think he realized what the extent was and what was going to come from his death, but it is absolutely, if there's anyone who's a hero, it would be Charles Skelly, because he was 25 years old. He died at that same night, 3 hours later, after he was shot, 1929. And it was after that is when ballistics and forensics essentially became mainstream, and they were finally accepted into the mainstream American society. And really, if it weren't for him, he was the one that provided the avenue, that they opened the door to that evidence. Without him being shot and killed, that evidence would have remained hidden. It may have been essentially gone at some point. Maybe the suspect would have taken off with it, and we'd be so far behind where we are now. And it's amazing to think that this one guy, this 25-year-old police officer, had that power to do that.
Did anything surprise you about Fred Burke when you were researching him? I mean, obviously, you know, he was a criminal who had this checkered past, but did anything stand out to you in this man's life or his history or anything?
Yeah, with Fred Killer Burke, he started out as a petty criminal into like forgeries and thefts and bad checks. And then he kind of graduated into something much more, into a hitman, machine gunner. And surprisingly, he learned how to shoot a machine gun while he was in World War I. He was actually sent over to France. He served in the army, and he learned how to shoot a machine gun there. And so that was kind of a surprising fact that, you know, he's considered a veteran. He learned how to shoot a machine gun, and instead of using that in a positive way, he came back and used it, obviously, in a negative way. And the one thing that I learned also is that Fred Burke never admitted to any crimes at all. He never said he committed anyone except where he killed Charles Skelly. That was the only crime that he ever admitted to doing. And he actually felt bad about it. And while he was being taken up to prison in Marquette, on the way up there, he said, "I'm sorry that I killed that boy." And I think that was about the softest and most compassionate thing he could have said. And coming from a killer of his stature, it's pretty amazing that he was able to admit that. And he did. But that's the only crime he ever admitted to. He would never say anything about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre or any of the other alleged crimes he was involved with, but he did at least fess up to this one.
So with that being said, what do you want audiences to take away from reading this book? What do you think they'll be most surprised by when they read it?
I think that mostly people will probably be surprised at, again, how the gangsters weren't necessarily so much bad guys when they were around here, and how actually accepted they were. You know, because you think about it, this is during the, right towards the end of the Roaring Twenties. The Depression has just started to set in. And when these guys would come into town, everybody knew it. And when they would come into town in their big black sedan, it was almost payday for so many businesses and so many people in industries in the Benton Harbor and St. Joseph area. And when he came into town, he spent money. And the businesses that he spent a lot of money at, restaurants, golf courses, and hotels, they were paid very generously with tips. And it's kind of hard to deny when you get a $500 tip, you know, from a gangster, and you don't even make that in a year, but you get that as a tip. And I think people appreciated that. It was obviously something they needed at that time. And while they were here, they were very courteous. They were gentlemen, from what many witnesses have described them as, and they were very respectful. And it's hard to put those words together with a name like Al Capone, because we know so much more about him on the other side. But surprisingly, when they were here, which is why I call the book Capone's Playground, this was their playground. They were on vacation. They were not doing their business. And they pretty much kept to that. So there was no crimes being committed necessarily, and they were very peaceful people. Up until the moment that Charles Skelly was killed in 1929, that's when it all changed. And that was really a pivotal moment, because at that point, the community in the area finally said that you're no longer welcome in our area. And that really was the kicker.
Author and historian Chris Lyon is the author of A Killing in Capone's Playground. She spoke with WMUK's Aaron Williams.